So the class today is continuing on the 12th canto. We just finished chapter 4. So this is the first verse of chapter 5, which is called the final instructions to Maharaj Parikshit. So this is very important because this is the last thing that Sukadeva Goswami is going to tell him to prepare him for his departure from this world. Shisuka uvacha.
Shisuka uvacha.
Shisuka uvacha.
Atra nuvanyate bhikshnam. Vishvatma Bhagavan Hari.
Vishvatma Bhagavan Hari.
Yasya prasadjo, prasadjo Brahma.
Yasya prasadjo Brahma.
Rudra krodha samudbhava.
Rudra krodha samudbhava.
Shri Sukha Uvacha.
Shri Sukha Uvacha.
Shri Sukadeva Goswami said,
Atra,
in this Srimad Bhagavatam,
Anuvarnyate,
is elaborately described,
Abhikshnam,
repeatedly.
Vishva Atma.
The soul of the entire universe. Bhagavan. The Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Hari.
Lord Hari.
Yasya.
Of whom?
Prashad.
From the satisfaction.
Born.
Brahma. Lord Brahma. Rudra, Lord Shiva, Krodha, from the anger, Samudbhava, whose birth. Translation. Sukadeva Goswami said, this Srimad Bhagavatam has elaborately described in various narrations the supreme soul of all that be, the personality of Godhead, Hari, from whose satisfaction Lord Brahma was born, and from whose anger Rudra takes birth. Please repeat. Sukadeva Goswami said, this Srimad Bhagavatam has elaborately described in various narrations the supreme soul of all.
The supreme soul of all that be.
The personality of Godhead Hari.
From whose satisfaction
Brahma is born.
And from whose anger
Rudra takes birth.
Purport, Mashallah,
purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has given a very elaborate summary of the Srimad Bhagavatam in his commentary on this verse. The essence of the great Acharya's statement is that unconditional loving surrender to the Supreme Lord Krishna, as described by Sukadeva Goswami, is the highest perfection of life. The exclusive purpose of the Srimad Bhagavatam is to convince the conditioned soul to execute such surrender to the Lord and go back home, back to Godhead. Om Ankinati Mahandasya Kina Kina Sarakaya Chakshu Ummilitam Gena Tasmai Shri Guruvay Namaha. So the Srimad Bhagavatam, as we all know, is in 12 cantos. And it's actually extremely subtly, scientifically presented transcendental knowledge. beginning from the first canto up to the ninth canto, so many subject matters have been discussed, and those subject matters are providing the reader with the proper conceptions to enter into the tenth canto. The proper conceptions, for example, people nowadays, they say so many things, and they use the word God. I think God this, God like that, God would like this, God wouldn't like that. There is no God. I don't believe in God. They say so many things. And if you try to understand what their conception is when they speak about God, it's very limited. It's a conception that they've formed from their experiences of this world, and they place it, they put these things together in their own mind, and they come to a conclusion, God is like that. So the Bhagavatam very quickly and very clearly steps way, way, way over the top of such an endeavor by explaining not actually God, but actually explaining the absolute truth, the Param Satyam, the Param Bonam, the Param Brahma. So many Sanskrit words are there, but the term that we translate into English is the absolute truth. What does that mean? Again, we need to enter into the concept of what we're saying, because if we just say words and we don't actually have any proper understanding of what these words mean, we don't deepen in our understanding and we don't deepen in our realization. And our Krishna consciousness doesn't become strong enough to surmount our material conceptions. It's like if you're building a house and you put some bamboo in India, you put some bamboo strips and you tie them together. If they're not strong enough, you shake them a little bit, and they're not strong enough, you won't want to step up there, because you'll be stepping up above the ground, and if they're a little shaky, then they could easily break and fall, and you could fall and hurt yourself. So therefore, until our concepts of Krishna consciousness are firm enough, we'll tend to sort of stay on the side of materialism. This is simple. It's not nothing mystical to it. It's very simple. Krishna consciousness is very simple and practical. And when our construct, by following the theology of the Bhagavatam, becomes firm, then we begin to venture forth to understand higher and higher levels of what is this absolute truth. Because the absolute truth, the concept alone, encompasses everything. So God, as a person, just God, he can be over there, I don't believe in him. So I turn my back on him and I go on with my life. And I'm living a kind of nice life. You know, I don't have to, I can be an atheist and I can get wealth and have success. And I can have nice children even. I can have everything that, and these poor people over here who are chanting Hare Krishna, they're kind of clumsy and they don't have any of the luxuries that I have, that they believe in God. I don't believe in God, and you see. And then Srila Prabhupada would come and he would speak very firmly that everyone in this world is miserable. And if our construction of Krishna consciousness isn't philosophically firm enough, we look around and we say, hang on, I'm miserable, they're having fun. Look at them, they've got money, fancy house, they live in Albert Park, they can afford a house, and I'm struggling to pay my rent. So I don't understand this, it doesn't add up. And this is because, as I said, we're still on this material level of conception of God. God is somebody I can take or leave. But when you come to this idea of the absolute truth, this vision of the truth, it encompasses everything. It encompasses us. It encompasses everyone. It encompasses all the elements that make up so-called reality. It encompasses the energy that causes people to forget God. It encompasses also the ability to remember God. All of it is encompassed within, just like inside an egg. Everything is within this concept of the absolute truth. And therefore you see, on the altar in Sri Mayapur Dham, the Panchatattva, five truths, We say Panchatattva Nityananda Chaitanya, and that's also true of five personalities. But also they represent five elements of the Absolute Truth. If you were to take the spiritual whole and divide it into segments so that we could understand it more clearly, you would come up with these components. These components comprise the spiritual Absolute Truth. So here in the Bhagavatam, Maharaj Parikshit is speaking to Sukadeva Goswami is speaking to Maharaj Parikshit, and he many times uses this word, the Absolute Truth. And this is also an interesting word, because for us that isn't the highest concept. We've learned about the Absolute Truth by the time we finished the ninth canto, through the various stories. You see, the Bhagavatam is written in stories. And stories, I saw recently a definition of the word lila. The word lila means the activities and exchanges between the Lord and his devotees. So all the tenth canto is full of lila. But it's not the lila of the Absolute Truth. It's the lila of the Supreme Personality, from whom everything that comprises the Absolute Truth is born. So he's the person. He's within it, he's beyond it, because he is the creator of everything. So whilst we wander around in our ordinary lives saying, I believe this, I don't believe this, I believe that, I want this, I don't want that, like little ants who might come crawling in here, an ant comes across here, and we watch the ant, and we try to avoid stepping on the ant, because the ant's situation is so humble. And the ant has no idea whatsoever that there are human beings who are huge in this room. What to speak of, that there's a sound vibration being generated between them that is something way beyond them even. All he knows is, I go from there to there sniffing for some sugar, and if I find something sweet, then my day has been successful. And I take it back, because that's my duty, and I do what I'm supposed to do, and the whole of my little colony thrives, or doesn't thrive, because maybe somebody becomes disgusted with us and pours some boiling water down the hole, and then we don't thrive. But if nothing like that happens, nothing unfortunate happens, we all go on with our ant-like existence, and this is everything to me. This is my ant world is reality. So Maharaj Parikshit, like the ant, if suddenly the boiling water is going to come down, trickling down through his tunnels and wipe out his whole everything, Maharaj Parikshit is seated before Sukadeva Goswami only a very, very fraction, short time before he's going to die. So this is so interesting, because in the first canto, Maharaj Parikshit, when he first meets all the sages, when he's given up everything, he understood that now my time has come. So he's separating himself from all his family responsibilities, because mostly we're so totally like the ant, we're totally absorbed in our responsibilities, and they comprise our life. So if somebody came up to you, you had a divine dream, and in the dream somebody said to you, you're going to die tomorrow. Be prepared. What would you do? It's an interesting thing, because what we think we'd do and what we would do are so different. The first thing that we would probably do is get terrified. No matter how much we say to people, I don't mind dying, you know, I haven't got a very happy life anyway, or my family can take care of themselves and all this up here in the head. But actually, if you suddenly realize somebody's going to pierce me, forget about everybody else, but it's going to happen to me, what am I going to do? It creates, unless someone is actually enlightened, it creates a type of terror in the heart. And then what do people do? Generally speaking, most people create the element of ignorance to try and suppress it and forget it in some form or another, just like ignorance in the form of drinking or sleeping or playing with something.
get onto the computer and check something, something, something. But actually, if you notice so many times when you're doing something like on the computer or shopping or the things that people do every day, you'll notice that you're disengaged while you're doing it. It doesn't actually take in all of you. You're just, your head is there and you're doing something. And you can't say you're disengaged in the sense that it's not hard work. But there's a part of you that actually doesn't take part in that. So the part that doesn't take part, this is actually the sleeping soul. So we try to put everything to sleep when we're frightened. Somehow, whatever our methodology may be, generally speaking, one will respond in this way, compulsively. But Maharaj Parikshit wasn't like us. He was already a liberated soul. He was already a deep, deep, deep devotee of the Lord. He had seen the Lord when he was in the womb, when he was about to be killed. Nowadays, so many children are killed and nobody thinks twice about it. Or maybe some people think it's terrible, but they cannot stop it because this is Kali Yuga and everything will just gradually get worse and worse and worse. So Maharaj Parikshit was not like that kind of situation. He was in the womb, already liberated, and suddenly he saw before him this beautiful, exquisite form of the Lord, effulgent and strong, and protecting him, standing between him and his death. And from that time on, when he came out of the womb into the world, he was conscious, he was separate from his mother, independent, he was searching for that person. He had seen them already. Where were they again? So this was the theme of his whole life. How can I find that person? Where are they? So he was very exceptional. Therefore, he is the one who's being chosen to receive these instructions. So Sukadeva Goswami, in the 11th canto, he gave so many analytical instructions to Maharaj Parikshit. This aspect of the absolute truth, because this word absolute truth, it implies everything, right? So we can analyze this and see this and think about this, and that's also a component of this and so on and so forth, and that's known as jnana. And this is very pleasant. Most people those who have an intelligence like to engage in jnana. And even those who don't, you see nowadays, they get on the internet and they find out information about any matter of subject that you would like, because the acquiring of knowledge is empowering, right? I recently spoke to one lady. She was from the Baha'i faith in Perth, and she said that she had converted from being a Muslim and in Iran, and so she was very much conscious of the oppression that can come when religion is done in a dogmatic fashion, the fanatical side of religion. And she had found the Baha'i faith very, very fascinating, because the key thing that she really liked was the fact that there's no one between me and God. We get rid of all the people in between. There's just me and God. And so we sat and listened to her. We couldn't really say anything because she, with her experience, this was an ideal conception for her, that there's nobody between me and God. She went on to say in a simple way, she said, nowadays there's so much education, the computers and everything else, everyone's so educated. In the olden days, they needed someone in between, like a priest or a guide or something. But nowadays, we're all so educated. We all have so much knowledge. We're empowered. So we don't need that. In fact, it gets in the way. So we've sort of, this is a relatively, it's a wonderful way to approach God and have God talk to you. So we didn't say so much to her, but of course as we went out the door we were thinking so many things about this concept. But this is what jnana is like. People feel empowered by it. They like it to know more on any subject. Now, here in this particular purport, Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur has given a very elaborate summary of the Srimad Bhagavatam in his commentary on this verse. The essence of the great Acharya's statement is that unconditional loving surrender to the Supreme Lord Krishna, as described by Sukadeva Goswami, is the highest perfection of life. If you read the Bhagavatam, you'll see in the 9th and the 10th and the 11th and the 12th, so many places Sukadeva Goswami says this, that hearing about Krishna is the method, hearing about Krishna is the perfection, hearing about Krishna will remove all your miseries. If you have desires, you don't have desires, you have desire for liberation, still hear about Krishna. He will highly recommend this throughout the Bhagavatam. You won't be able to miss it. Yet, Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur explains in his purport that now these final instructions, these most important, relevant final instructions, because isn't it, if you really want to spoil something for yourself, you pick up a novel and you read the last page. You've spoiled it. You can't read the rest because you found out how it ended. So the ending is so important. The whole book is leading up to this culmination point. It ended like this. So here, the final instructions. What is he going to tell him? We're hearing here the Acharyas, Vishwanatha Chakravarti, saying this. This is the final ending of the Bhagavatam. But as you read through this very short chapter, it's only 13 verses, he will give, Sukadeva Goswami will give a very analytical, jnana-like presentation of what is actually the final culmination point of what Sukadeva Goswami is recommending him to concentrate on at the time of his death. And of course, every point that he makes in this presentation, transcendental presentation, will be very relevant and very important for us to hear, for others to hear. But it's interesting to note that he's not going to talk about unconditional loving surrender. When you read it, if you're a fine reader of the Bhagavatam, I know for myself, I'm not a fine reader of the Bhagavatam, but I like stories. So when it goes into some philosophy, I turn a few pages and wait for the next story. You know, women and sisters in Kali Yuga are allowed to be like that. Therefore, there's the Mahabharata. So I'm not so much interested in philosophy. I turn those pages over. So I remember reading the 12th canto and coming to this and actually previously thinking, oh, I wonder what he said. And I thought, this is so analytical. How boring. And sort of turned over the page. So yesterday, when coming to prepare this verse, I asked my husband, do you have this summary of the Srimad Bhagavatam by Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur? It's not here. And because he's very studious and collects various things, he said, yes, I have a copy. So we looked at it together. And it was very interesting because Sukadeva Goswami, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, is giving, it's not really a commentary as such, it's many verses, evidence. Because actually a commentary is like in the law courts. You have to give evidence. You can't just say your own opinion. I think God is dead. I don't think God minds if I do this. I know God's pleased if I'm like this. On and on and on. And that's just common people's talk. It's not scientific. So nobody should base their whole life on something that somebody says in a whimsical, subjective way. If one wants to create that strong structure, that I can climb up this structure and get free of the material concepts and ideas and values that are plaguing me now and making my Krishna consciousness so shaky, then I have to get the right understanding from the right source and follow that. So he explains there that Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur explains with all these evidences how, yes, surrender, devotion is the highest. So why does Sukadeva Goswami speak in this way? He gives a very nice little insight. He explains that if you have a very valuable jewel, say I have a very valuable, priceless jewel, no one's ever seen one like this before, and it's worth millions, it's worth more than I can even estimate. I don't take that very valuable jewel down to the Swanson Street and Burke Street or wherever corner and say to everyone, look, I've got this valuable jewel, you see, isn't it amazing? Because what might happen? It might be stolen. It might be taken by the wrong person. So interestingly enough, what Sukadeva Goswami does is he camouflages this point about loving surrender to Krishna. He hides it by the barrier of jnana, of knowledge, so that those who are only really interested in finding out knowledge on this subject, a little of this, I can write my theses, I can do this, I, they're not actually interested in surrender. They can grab that knowledge, and it will benefit them, because it is transcendental knowledge. But they will be led to the conclusion that this is the essence of the Srimad Bhagavatam, to understand all this subject matter. And I understand this subject matter, and I feel very good, or I don't feel very good, and I go. But those who actually are fortunate, and we should all become fortunate souls, they should be going beyond that point. Beyond just trying to empower myself so I feel good about myself. To try to understand what is my function. Because until I find out what my function is, I'm a bit useless. If I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing with my life, I'll wander from this to that, to that, to this. I'll decide on this, and then I'll get sick of that, and I'll go there. And that's how people live their lives. And the concept of duty is very difficult to find in the modern world. It's difficult to find it in relationship to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So therefore it filters down that you don't find it in relationship to anything. And you take a duty and then you leave it. And you go here and you go there. Maybe you won't, but so many people will. So, first of all, one has to have gone through all of the Bhagavatam and then heard about the pastimes of Krishna. If you hear the pastimes without the knowledge previous to the 10th canto, you may have misconceptions. You may think, oh, he's like an ordinary child. He's just so cute. We'll make some cartoons about him. Then we can show them to the kids. And they can see cartoon Krishna, we can make comic books about him, he's cute, he's good subject matter. But some of the parts I don't like, so we'll edit them out and we'll just pop something else in there and we'll go on, no problem, everything's good, he's good, he's good. But it won't bring about the change, the total transformation that the Bhagavatam is meant to bring in the lives of misdirected people. It won't bring it about unless we understand that this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the source, the controller of everything. And even your ignorance and your illusion is given to you by Him. And He can remove it if you want it removed. But He won't remove it unless you want it removed. Because He's all-loving. And so what He does is He reciprocates what you want. And oh my goodness, how much responsibility that places on our shoulders. He's reciprocating with me. I'm seated in everyone's heart. From me comes knowledge, remembrance, forgetfulness. He's giving us that. He's giving us the clouds of darkness. He's giving us the illumination. We have no qualification to receive these things other than to accept what He's giving. And therefore, the highest, most beneficial thing that a soul can do is unconditionally surrender to Him and say to Him, which is what Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur is saying. He can say, and Srila Prabhupada gives a very simple statement you can offer. It's not a very complicated thing to say, like you don't have to say, I from now on I'm totally surrendered to you, because we're not. We have so many desires, so if we say that, it will be hollow. And he's in your heart, he knows you're not, so he won't sort of like bestow you with everything because you say, I want it all. But we can say, my dear Lord Krishna, for so many lifetimes I've forgotten you. And now I've come to consciousness of you. Please accept me. And in one of those very small books of Srila Prabhupada's, he gives this little prayer and he says that if you pray like this, the obstacle will be removed immediately. So this is the appropriate mood for somebody who wants to actually become a lover, who wants to become full, who wants to help other people, who wants to know what their part in the whole of everything is. They have to come to this point. They can take the knowledge of the Bhagavatam and stop there. Or they can take the knowledge of the Bhagavatam, like you'll see, Maharaj Purkit, he hears everything that Sukadev says, and then when Sukadev says to him, I've told you everything now, he says to him, I've told you everything now, if there's anything, are there any more questions, tell me whatever you need to know further. And what does Maharaj Purkit says? He says, nothing. He says, thank you in a very obviously respectful and adoring way to Sukadeva Goswami. And then he says, I have all the knowledge now. Now I want to fix my mind. I want to fix my mind on the personality of Godhead. So this means that while he was receiving all this knowledge, he wasn't fooled. So this is what the great Acharya Vishwanath says, is that for those who are worthy of being fooled, he hides it, this bhakti principle, because it's so relishable. And for those who have the right understanding, the right quality of heart, this knowledge will be very helpful to detach them from the materialistic ways of the world, and it will simultaneously attach them. That I just want Krishna. I want my relationship with you to be established. And that is not meaning I want you to help me with my life because I've got a problem with this and I need some more this and I want this and that. Because that is the relationship of Krishna with our mind and bodies. Because now in our ignorance we think this is me. So I want to have a relationship with the deities. So fortunately for people ignorant like ourselves, we can do the puja, the archana process. You take your mind and body, who you think you are, and you use it and you train it to be offering something to the Lord. But beyond that, I'm a soul. And so who I am, if I am that, I'm not this, then what is my relationship? This is something very transcendental. Very much beyond where our ant-like minds normally go. We don't usually think like that. But this is what the Bhagavad Gita, is the A, B, C, is bringing us towards, and the Srimad Bhagavatam is taking you towards. And then, as Srila Prabhupada explained, in the Chaitanya Chaitamrita, you can actually see the actions of transcendence. Because Lord Chaitanya comes, and rather than Krishna, who says, you surrender unto me and I will reward you accordingly, Lord Chaitanya is mad. He's a madman. Advaita Acharya calls him in the sonnet at the end of the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya. He writes a little poem to him. Because it was Advaita Acharya who called Lord Chaitanya to descend, so Advaita Acharya also hands him, through a messenger, a little poem which is telling him, now you can ascend. And in there he says, tell the bowl. So if you have ever have any history of Bengal, you know they're called bowls and owls. And there they wear long matted hair and they sing songs and take drugs and do all kinds of strange things. They're not what you'd say a bona fide sadhana bhakta people. And Advaita Acharya says, as one madman to another, and he gives his message that And everybody, when they heard this extraordinary simple little sonnet, like a riddle, they all became very worried. That, this doesn't feel very good. And Lord Chaitanya went deeper into transcendental consciousness. And he went deep into madness. So that the scholars and the historians can just write, he was an epileptic and he suffered from epileptic fits because they had no access to where he went. He went deeper into transcendence and revealed this for everyone to see. But we cannot read this and understand it properly if we don't do the A, B, C, D and all the other study. We can't go to the PhD level if we're still in the beginning stage. So Prabhupada recommended, please read my books, read my books. The knowledge you may not, while you're reading, think, oh, I've read that, okay, I've read that, I don't feel any different. But gradually, the accumulative knowledge, it will change your conceptions. And it's our conceptions which cause us to function in this world. I think this is good, I think that's bad, I'm not going to do that, I'll avoid this. So as the Bhagavatam reacts with the ignorance in our heart and consciousness, we can perceive that it's enlightening us. And when we come to the fortunate position of aligning ourselves with this simple prayer that Srila Prabhupada has given us, for so many lifetimes, I've forgotten you. Now I've come to consciousness of you. Please accept me. When we can align our heart and our thinking with such a simple request, then the Bhagavatam becomes like a jewel-filled book, like a jeweled treasure case, rather than a literature with very much knowledge which we may believe or not believe or accept or not accept and so forth. So this is the significance of Sukadeva Goswami's speaking about the Bhagavatam and glorifying the Bhagavatam in this verse and then proceeding to give these analytical instructions, requesting Sukadeva Goswami to use his intelligence and set himself up, when in fact what Parikshit Maharaj is going to do is he's going to use his heart and he's going to surrender completely and meditate on the beautiful pastimes that he has heard in the 10th canto already. At the end of the 11th canto, before the start of the 12th canto, Sukadeva is explaining the departure of the Lord, how he departed, and after he departed, he says to him, so then after that Arjuna came to Hastinapura and he established Vrajana, was the great-grandson of Krishna as the king, and you, Maharaj Parikshit, you became established as in your position at that time also. And then in the first chapters of the 12th canto, he starts telling him what's ahead about Kali Yuga, about the kings that are going to come after him. And he starts telling him about the characteristics of Kali Yuga and the victimization that's about to occur. And Maharaj Parikshit becomes very anxious, being such an exalted, compassionate personality. He feels for the people who are about to be victimized by all these horrible qualities that Kali Yuga is going to degrade by, just like cycling down, down, down. And we can see this around us. In a lifetime, you'll be horrified when you see how people are going down, 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 without any care for understanding anything other than just that enjoyment and selfishness is the purpose of their life. So then he asked questions out of concern, and Sukadeva Goswami answered his questions, and in the chapter prior to this one, he explains to him four kinds of annihilation, which is interesting. It's like if you ask somebody, tell me about something, and they say, well, you could die like this. You could be smashed into pieces. You know, he starts telling him what we would consider very uncomfortable information, quite negative to hear about annihilation over and over again. Nobody finds it in the world today entertaining if you go to some social function and start talking about debt. They'll change the subject. But Parikshit Maharaj is on the threshold of his own annihilation. And in the next verse of the Bhagavatam, second verse of this chapter, the first thing that Maharaj Parikshit is told by Sukadev, he says, "O king, give up the animalistic mentality of thinking I am going to die. Give it up. Unlike the body, you have not taken birth. Your body has taken birth. You have not taken birth. There was not a time in the past when you did not exist, and you are not about to be destroyed." So this is very powerful after describing the destruction of the universe. In every evening of Lord Brahma, everything is destroyed and a huge fire takes over the whole 100 years, no rain. Just think about that. And everything turns boiling and people start eating each other because there's nothing. And then the whole universe of fire comes up and everything is just turned to a shell. And this happens every evening of Lord Brahma's life. And Lord Brahma's life is just inconceivably long. So here we are, the ant crawling across the room. How can I believe that there are people big in this room? How can I believe they have things like microphones? You know, we don't have them. How can they have them? So Maharaj Parikshit is being prepared for this point. And it's interesting that if you're lamenting about something, it's a sort of human tendency to tell somebody what was the famous Australian saying, "It could have been worse." So he's being told, yes, look at this, and you look at this, wow. And then in that, explains here that, I think in this particular, or the next chapter, next verses, that this put everything into perspective for the king, that actually it's inevitable for all of us, it's all inevitable, it's all the arrangement of this personality within whom everything is, and everything is cycling round and round and round within him. It's inevitable, so let me find my relationship with him, and let me take shelter of him, and then everything will become wonderful. So this is the instruction, final instruction for him, and it's also, of course, a very important instruction. Hopefully, or maybe, it's our final instruction, but I think we need a lot more instruction as well. But we can take this deeply to heart, then we'll be very benefited. Thank you. Does anyone have any questions?
Yes. Well, in the last chapter, we heard that Lord Shiva removed the anchor of the Yogis surrender. So, how does he remove the anchor?
Lord Shiva removes the anchor?
No, we don't know this verse in the last chapter.
Last chapter.
That Lord Shiva removes the anchor.
Do you know where that was?
Possible.
Do you know which verse that was?
No.
Long way away or just in the last?
Maybe before.
A bit long. He removes the ahamkar, Lord Shiva. Well,
Srila Prabhupada also said that if we worship Lord Shiva with the view that he is a pure devotee of Krishna, then he removes the false ego.
Well, the thing is that in Brahma Samhita, the position of Lord Shiva is described. And Lord Shiva is he's the Mahadev, he's the master of the material world. So he's also a Vaishnava. So it's like if you come to live in some place under the jurisdiction of someone and you appeal to them as your king, that give me this, give me that, I want one of these, I want one of these, and so forth,
then he may very kindly bestow those things upon you and you'll live happily in his kingdom. But if you approach him to say, actually, I want to go to a higher place, and he comes from that place, and he checks your qualification, and you actually have the right qualification to go to that place where he's from, then if he's very kind, he might say to you, all right, I'll help you to get there. Most people pray to Lord Shiva to make them happy and comfortable and settled in the material world. Only a devotee can pray to Lord Shiva to remove ahankar, false ego, ignorance. No one else will pray for that. So the right understanding of Lord Shiva and the right understanding of ourself will prompt us to pray to him in that way. Then he has the authority and power to be able to help us in that way.
He meditating on Sankarsana, Lord Sankarsana, all the time. I think third chapter, 26th chapter.
Yes.
That he worshipped. So he has got that power to.
Yeah. Really, he knows the king of that place. So if he puts in a good word and says, this is one of my people, but he's really meant to be with you, then he can do anything because of his position. Simply put. Yeah.
I just had a question about the term prasada jal, where it says from whose satisfaction from heart
is
born. Yeah. Do you know why it satisfies the Lord for Brahma to be born?
Well, again, referring to the Brahma Samhita, which is the essence of the understanding Lord Brahma and the teachings. Lord Brahma finds himself as the creator of the material world. He finds himself alone. If you're going to create something, you'll be prior to the creation itself. He finds himself alone and he's not quite sure what to do or where he came from. Where did his existence begin? So he makes very extensive effort to try to understand his origin, but he's bewildered in doing that and he can't actually come to any he can't access it. He has no access. And then he hears, again, as if there's somebody over, an overseer who's watching. Say, if you have somebody in a room, they're trying to find the door. And then if a voice of somebody who's observing them from outside tells them, go to the corner, right, then they see, oh, there's a door. So then he hears the words, ta-pa, ta-pa, two Sanskrit syllables, which together combined indicates that he should perform activities to purify himself before trying to understand this. And he does. And so because he performs the instructed process that's given to him before he can understand what he wants to understand, he pleases the person who wants to enlighten him. And then that person can enlighten you. But if you don't perform the process to first of all become receptive for that enlightenment, it won't be given in such a way. So therefore it is said that from whose satisfaction the Brahma is born. He's born, I guess you could, it's not quite the answer exactly because he's born. I think we need to ask somebody more scholarly about this, about his birth actually coming from there. But this is how he certainly pleased the Lord. How does he, is that from the satisfaction of the Lord he's born?
Why is that Mahatma?
Can anyone throw some enlightenment on this?
It says he was born from the satisfaction of I was looking at it last night, I could look at prasada is translated as satisfaction. Prasada also can mean mercy.
In other words, his verb, the Lord is always satisfied, but he's obviously never dissatisfied. And an aspect of his satisfaction is Goloka Vrindavan, an aspect of his satisfaction is Vaikuntha, an aspect of his satisfaction is the material world. The material world is an opportunity for conditioned souls, such as me, to perfect their consciousness and come home to Krishna. So because Brahma, being a devotee, is the facilitator of that, and also he has a tendency to create control as well, but as the facilitator of that, he pleases Krishna as by being born, and Krishna's satisfaction is fulfilled because the living entities will have an opportunity to come to him and things like that. That's what I would say. Not so scholarly. Because he's always satisfied, that's the interesting thing. So there's just different aspects of his satisfaction that exist. So the material world is an aspect of his satisfaction. A good place to put the criminals, to the criminals.
Well, I understand. Thank you, Lord. You're very welcome. How does Rudra take birth from the anger of Lord Krishna?
Well, Rudra takes birth from the anger of Lord Brahma. So I was looking at this and wondering if it was which person's anger Rudra was born from, but then if Lord Brahma is born from Hari and Rudra is born from Brahma, then you could say in that sense that Rudra is also born from Hari. And we do understand that Lord Rudra, Lord Shiva, he has to be there for the purpose of annihilation. There has to be annihilation. If there's creation, there has to be annihilation. You might say, why does there have to be annihilation? Well, there has to be annihilation if you're working within a material world, which is a temporary, totally transformative energy. There has to be the element to transform it, to make it go down as well as going up. So Rudra performs that function.
Mother, from your answer, what I'm understanding is that Lord is always satisfied, as Buddha said, he is always happy.
Mm.
But why should he be angry so that Krishna, Lord Shiva is born, Rudra is born?
Why shouldn't he be angry?
What makes him angry?
What makes him angry?
Yeah.
What makes him angry?
What
makes you angry?
His anger is also his pleasure. From a material point of view, we see anger and being happy as opposed to each other. But on the spiritual realm, on the spiritual platform, all the emotions exist. It's not just shanti, shanti, peacefulness and nothingness. There's a full variety of emotions there. Full variety of emotions coming from Krishna.
That's really important in this concept change from God who, you know, does the good things in the world and the devil who does the bad things in this world, to come to this more full understanding. Otherwise you feel that, you know, you can do the good things in this world. You know, you can help in this way and that way, whereas if you understand in that way that everything is actually within him, the full range of emotions, and yet they're transcendental to these the things that we see and the way we see things.
it's much easier to understand him. Any other questions? Yes.
Do you have an example of Christians becoming angry in the Gauloka Vrindavan?
You mean up there or down here?
How about when his mother didn't feed him? He got quite angry. He was so angry that he broke a pot of butter and he fed butter to the monkeys. And he felt quite justified when his mother had left him.
When the ladies told so many stories of the naughty things he'd done in their homes, he'd come and he had done this, he had done that. Sometimes he got angry at them and said, "Why are you telling all these things about me? I'm such a nice little boy. I never do anything naughty." And he preferred to kill demons when he went out to play. So you have to have a bit of anger to kill demons.
Putana.
But when he closed his eyes in anger, he blessed her. It's described that he blessed her. He became angry that she'd come like this. He was angry at her. Actually, he was angry because she had killed so many small babies in Raja. And that made him angry. But she was promoted to the position of being like his mother as a result of his anger. And everything also has a history. Previously, he had another birth and another birth, and Putana was actually, in a previous life, wanted that, and so she received it. She was the sister, I think, of Bali Maharaj, she was a relative of Bali Maharaj, and when she saw Vamana Dev, he was so beautiful and like the ideal beautiful child. She felt so much maternal affection towards him. But then when he took everything from Bali Maharaj, she became very angry. So she had these two things there. And so his anger removed her anger, and then she received what she really wanted. Any other? There are a couple more questions. Yes?
Maharaji, you said that the key of Sukadeva Goswami's instruction is to surrender. But then you told us Prabhupada's prayer, Krishna, can you please accept me?
Mm-hmm.
So if we think about surrender, you might think, oh, I can surrender. But if we pray to be accepted, then that's something that Krishna has to do. He gives us mercy.
That's the other side. It's two sides to surrender. That's why surrender is a little scary. And we see in the movies, you know, when there's one big rough, violent person comes and there's a group of people and they're helpless and they're cowering in a corner, and then they sort of say, "I surrender." Or even if there's two powerful people fighting and one dominates the other, then they say, "I surrender." So it implies that one is stronger, and so the other one somehow or other has to succumb. So there's two sides to that surrender. There's the side of the person who's being forced to surrender, and there's the side of the person who's forcing them to surrender. Right, so once this person who's being forced to surrender surrenders, the person in control can do anything they want. Right? And they can kill them, or they can cut them up into little pieces. They can do anything because they've now surrendered to them. So Srila Prabhupada is showing us a different kind of relationship of surrender. That it's not one of being sort of thrashed into the corner, but it's one of becoming conscious of one's relationship, and then requesting to be accepted. But still, Krishna may or may not choose to accept you. He has the freedom to do that because he's the superior to whom we're coming. But if he doesn't choose to accept you, what should you do? keep trying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he's ever merciful, so there's some good reason why he's not willing to accept you right at that moment. There may be some lurking insincerity still that's pushing you into this state of mind, and he wants to remove that also so that the surrender is genuine. Any other? Yes.
Could you please speak a little bit about Vrindavan's Thakur, his disappearance day?
Is it?
What did you mean?
He asked, could I speak about Vrindavan Das Thakur because it's his disappearance day today? Well, we're a little late, so in brief, Vrindavan Das Thakur was the son of Narayani Devi. Narayani Devi was a little girl at the time of Lord Chaitanya when he was in Nadia, in Navadvipa. And she was in the house of Srivas. She was staying in the house of Srivas Pandit. And one time, Lord Chaitanya gave her his remnants. And then later on, she was married, and she became pregnant with Vrindavan Das, and then her husband passed away. So she was under the care, I think, of... in the ashram on the other side of the Ganga. Does anyone know?
That ashram is like a family ashram.
Yes. Near to Janadweep, and the next one. You might have to look up to get the exact details, but anyway, she was living under the care, I think, of Vasudev Datta, Mukunda Datta, as far as I know. They took care of her. And Vrindavan Das grew up in that way, hearing all about Lord Chaitanya and his pastimes in Navadweep. And then when he became of age, he started to write, and he wrote the beautiful Chaitanya Bhagavat, which I think was first called the Chaitanya Charita, something like that. Chaitanya Mangal. And then the name was changed to the Chaitanya Bhagavat. And all the writers who wrote about Lord Chaitanya's life thereafter, you know, some years later, they all refer to Vrindavan Das like they do to Vyasadeva, that he was the compiler of the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya. He's considered very primary. And he writes in a very buoyant, happy way. And he addresses certain traits that the Vaishnavas have to learn to remove from their hearts. And he keeps continuously, constantly telling us of the mercy of Lord Chaitanya. And particularly, even more than the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, he talks about the mercy of who? Not Vaishnavas. Nityananda. Yeah, also Vaishnavas, of course. But he's particularly fond of, he took initiation from Lord Nityananda. So he tells us some very wonderful stories in the Chaitanya Bhagavat. It's considered essential. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur would have all of his disciples reading the Chaitanya Bhagavat over and over and over. So he's the acharya for that. Thank you. Any other? Yes.
Like you were mentioning that towards the end in the 12th canto, Sukadeva Goswami is covering up the pure aspects and giving more of jnana as the others go to Parikshit Maharaj. But we also hear that Srimad Bhagavatam is the Amala Puran, and it has come to give the highest form of bhakti or highest revelation of truth to people, especially in Kali Yuga, when Krishna has already left the planet. So, then how do we understand this aspect that people can get misguided if they read the 12th canto?
Well, it's not quite like that. He didn't quite do that, but Srila Chakravarti Thakur says that my Lord, Sri Krishna, he likes everything kind of kept private, keeps the confidential things confidential. But I've told everything in the 10th canto. This is his mood. He said, that must mean that I'm not close to him. He's not pleased with me because I have told everything. This is just a special mood, not a logical thing. So then he thought to himself, so therefore I will put a little barrier like this of gyan, and the devotees in Maharaj Pariket was one, they'll immediately see through it and they will continue on. And those who are inclined towards gyan, the teachings of the Bhagavatam are always perfect. So they'll take you to the platform of gyan, and then, but it's not only gyan, it's not like impersonal gyan, but you can exercise all your intelligence and everything, and then by that process you may want to come further. But there are those people who want to go there, so the Bhagavatam gives something for everyone. And it gives the highest thing, so as one's purified, one can access to that. So simultaneously he hides it, and he says that Maharaj Pariket will not be confused. And for the devotees, he explains, this particular gyan will help them with their bhakti. So this is a very important point, because we do need some gyan. One time I was listening to Prabhupada in a lecture, and he said, the residents of Vrindavan, they never knew who Krishna was. They never thought of him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They just loved him as he was. And he was explaining this point. And then he said, of course, he said, for you, you need to know who he is. And then he said, otherwise you might neglect him. So that we don't neglect the transcendental nature of the Bhagavatam, we need this knowledge. So it's very nourishing, but we don't think that this is the ultimate platform, just to know how the material world is miserable and to know about everything, all the elements and so forth, but that helps us to become detached and actually strive to move forward on the path of bhakti itself. Any other questions? Did you have a question there? No.
I would ask my question.
Okay. All right, so I think we've finished. Any more questions? No? All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.